Hello, friends. I'm Lee Brown. This is Crazy Shit in Real Estate. Today, we're talking to Joe Evangelisti, and you're going to learn things, and I'm learning things, and holy smokes, I'm totally ready to go do some more interesting things in real estate after hearing this story. So buckle up, enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to Crazy Shit in Real Estate. You'll be amazed at all these wild but true situations that others have found themselves in. Because on this show, you'll hear uncensored, unbelievable stories from the world of real estate. I'm Lee Brown. Let's dive right in.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
So tell my audience who Joe Evangelisti is and what do you do in and around real estate? You've already mentioned architect out of the side of your mouth. Was that a project you're working on, or give us some skinny? How do we know Joe?
Are we going to jump right into it, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, actually. So
here we are not fancy.
That's fine. That's fine. I'm trying to shake a bad habit I have of building and flipping houses. I did it for about 12 years. And then about 4 years ago, we switched all into self-storage development. And so actually, to take it back a minute, I grew up as a child of a general contractor. My dad's a GC, always has been. He was a builder. He's a drywall guy when I was a kid. And, you know, like from this tall, I was able to push a broom and tape drywall probably by the time I was 10 or 12. And so it's just always been in my blood, building stuff and creating stuff from nothing and, you know, being able to look back at the finished product and have that sense of pride. I did the same thing in the military for about 6 years. I was a Navy builder and in the Seabees, which is the construction battalion of the Navy. Most people don't even know that they exist, but I had the pleasure and the blessing to go and be able to do what I love doing and serve our country and be in the military at the same time, hence the American flag. But yeah, so about 4 years ago, we were flipping, you know, about 100 houses a year. We did about 1,000 over the course of 12 years. Okay. And really just, you know, at a meeting one time at the end of the year, me and my business partner sat down and we're like, okay, what's the goal for next year? We did 88 this year. You want to do 120? And he was like, dude, I don't want to do 88 again. And I was like, well, I'm glad you said it because, you know, I'm losing my passion for it and I'm kind of losing my excitement for it. And so we really took a minute to kind of slow down, to speed up and really kind of digest like what we have done and where we wanted to go. And you know, so I started looking for bigger, more scalable assets and, you know, dug around in multifamily. I have friends that are in multifamily at a big level, and I've owned apartment buildings in the past. And, you know, we found that it was super congested and very difficult. Like, I'm a big believer in the blue ocean strategy. If you're familiar with that, it's like, you know, go where the sharks are not feeding. And, you know, at the time, it just felt like all the sharks were, you know, in a feeding frenzy in multifamily. And so, you know, where else would I go? And this is before COVID. So, of course, the world hadn't come to an end yet. And it was like, well, we looked at multi, we looked at retail, we looked at office. And then one day I was on the phone with my now mentor, one of my mentors that I had just met. And we spent about 2 hours. I called him up and we spent like 2 hours on the phone. I don't know if I'm sure you've had phone calls like that where you're like, man, you just have like, you click. Yes. And this guy named Sean, and Sean was on his fourth self-storage facility at the time. Mm-hmm. And he had the same background that I had. He had built houses in the Hamptons. He had built restaurants. He had built planned unit developments in the Carolinas, built thousands of houses. And he said to me, Joe, once you build a self-storage, you'll never build a house again for the rest of your life. You won't even build your own house. Right. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I'm like, man, what is he talking about? But guess what? He's right. Right. You build a self-storage facility, it's massively larger. It's massively larger numbers. But at the end of the day, it's steel, concrete, and asphalt. Like, it's so basic. You're building steel boxes. So to bring it full circle to the conversation I was just having with my architect is, my dad is now retired. I bought his company about 6-7 years ago, basically effectively put him on the payroll and told him I'd pay him for the rest of his life because I owe him everything. And I'm still looking for like pet projects to keep him busy. So my architect finds this little subdivision of 3 lots about a mile from my house. And I'm saying to myself, well, this is good to keep my dad busy. He can go build some houses on the side. And that's what the conversation was about.
And with the speed of labor and materials right now, he can take his own sweet time and nobody can say anything about it.
He might spend the rest of his retirement building 3 houses. We'll find out. But you know, I still think it's an opportunity. Yeah, that's right.
So you learned how to build basically your own ATM because that's what a self-storage unit is. Now, we know that they're everywhere. And I think no matter what market you're in, you can't drive anywhere without seeing them crop up. And it's all the way from the basic old school corrugated steel building to the 4-story air conditioned climate controlled with an elevator version.
Yep.
Talk to me about how that works with zoning and getting approvals, because it must not be that hard because they get approved, it seems like, everywhere. And by the way, where are you located? Because I'm in North Carolina.
So I'm in New Jersey, but we're building all over the United States right now. From right now, we have sites all the way to mid Texas, but we're looking at stuff in Utah and California and Nevada right now. So
the taxes are kind of high up there.
Yeah. But to answer your first question, you know, my chief development officer, who I hired a few years ago, one of our first conversations we had together, this guy had built 300, he's over 400 self-storage facilities by now. He was at like 3.25 a couple of years ago. And he said to me, Joe, you could take a dart, throw it at the map of the United States, build a self-storage there and be successful. Of course, that's not the idea. What we want to do is find the best MSA location, demographics, income levels, and then try to reverse engineer getting a site into that area.
Okay.
So that's what we do, right? We don't want to throw darts, even though you could. There's some interesting statistics about this business. 98% of self-storage facilities that are built are successful. And that's mind-boggling to some
people. Right. 98%?
98% of, you know, I think it weighs into two different things. One is the understanding of just how unsaturated the markets are in a lot of places. Now, there are places that have excessive amounts of storage, but that they're very few and far between. There's such a big need for this business around the country, and people just don't realize it, but it serves so many. And this is also why I love it as an insulator and as a diversification asset, is it serves so many people. I mean, it serves contractors, it serves attorneys and insurance companies that are storing files, it stores people who are downsizing their office and they want to put their furniture somewhere. It stores, there's certain storages, I guess, again, zoning specific, where you're keeping classic cars or your second car or your other vehicle. Then it goes to the consumer, right? The everyday upsizer, downsizer, I'm moving. You know, you got millennials now who don't want to buy and be anywhere, but they still have stuff. So they put their stuff in there and they move across the country. It serves so many vast dichotomy of people that it's necessary. And it's needed, and it's needed in a lot of places that you already see it. Most of these storage facilities you drive by on a given day, you don't realize it, but they're 100% occupied, or they're 98% occupied. You know, you can't find a 5x5. There might only be a 10x30 available. So it's interesting in that, and the industry is so frothy right now, but it's necessary, it's needed, and that's what makes it fun for me, you know.
So yeah, as a real estate office, we have a storage unit, and there's one for the signs and the stuff. And we still have our brochure boxes in there. I need to let go of those because brochures are never coming back. But there's also a separate unit we have. We do a prom dress drive every year to provide prom dresses to kids that can't afford one. And there's 500 dresses in that one. And I guess in my thought process, as we're looking for a unit, I thought just our area was full on storage because we had to call so many different facilities to find in the right size. But I guess I thought it was just the Charlotte area. I didn't think it was everywhere.
No, it really is. I had one of my investors near my house years ago when we first started pivoting from single family to storage. I'm selling him on the idea. I'm like, you know, we're going to go build storage. And of course, at very first, people were like, you've never done this before. Why would I invest money? And they're like, okay, well, we've done hundreds of deals with you in single family. You got to trust me. I know what we're talking about. So, you know, we had lunch and he was like, I'll mull it over or whatever. He calls me like 3 weeks later and he says to me, I got to tell you a funny story. He goes, I'm looking for your pro forma, looking through your deck. I really do like the idea of the deal. I'm just, you know, curious of whether or not you can go on and take this because you've never done this before. He goes, but my wife calls me and says, I think we should sell the house and downsize. They had just bought a house in Florida. They were looking for a smaller condo up here. And he goes, I literally got in my car, drove right down the street. He lives a half mile from a site. A storage facility, went in, can I get a unit? Nope, we're booked. Get in my car, drove again, can I get a unit? No, we're booked. He goes, I went to 5 facilities within 5 miles of my house and I can't get a unit. He goes, I'm in. You know, so it is really that saturated. It's crazy. As Americans, we just don't let go of our stuff. But you also just gave two other great examples of why people would put stuff in storage, right?
Yeah. Again, it's all stuff, right? It's not just your sentimental stuff. Like I've got my great grandmother's furniture right here around me in my dining room and my kids don't want it. And exactly. So when I downsize one day, I'm not getting rid of it. It's going to
get rid of it.
And then I'm going to be dead. And I guess it'll wind up on Storage Wars, which frankly is one of my favorite TV shows ever. And I do have to go down that rabbit hole. Has that changed how people look at storage units? Because I know that a friend of mine owns one locally, and he said after that show started some several years ago, suddenly the auctions became the hip and cool thing to do. But drove him crazy because it was kind of the dumb people who showed up to bid on it. But that's the discussion.
And so, yeah.
Tell us about that side of things and how often do storage facilities have to auction off a unit because the person vanishes? Because if they're that full, how much of them are producing and how many need to be auctioned off?
Well, so I'll start off by saying I'm always good at not knowing what I don't know. And I don't really speak to things I don't know very well. We're pure developers, right? I'm building self-storage and I'm handing it off. No, I watch the show. And I watch the show. But what I'm saying is I don't have any personal experience with that because our management companies would do that. However,
now I'm sad. I want the good stuff.
That being said, I think it's fairly rare that that happens because the thing about self-storage is really interesting with tenancy is, and it's what's different than residential, is let's say you're spending $85 a month to put your stuff in storage. The next month you go to show up and you didn't pay your bill. You can't get through the gate. You can't even go get your stuff. Yeah. So you have two options at that point. You swipe your credit card and pay the $85 that's past due, or you never see your stuff again. And so from a psychological standpoint, what are people going to do? They're going to pay the $85, even if they're just pulling in to get their stuff out and leave it. The reality of it is, I think those shows, much like the HGTV movement of flipping houses, you know, half believe about 5% of what you see. It's staged. You know, I don't know that to be a fact, but I firmly believe that it's pretty staged. You know, I don't think they're going
to
go.
I don't want you to say that because I enjoy. People don't listen to Joe. He's obviously making shit up. Okay, so.
I mean, listen, you can go flip houses. You can buy one for 150, put 50 grand into it and sell for 750. They do that all the time on flipping shows, and right?
They don't have to put any money into it. And the materials cost like $5.
Yeah, it's like $6 an hour for labor, right? And the tile guys just show up and the next day it's done. Yeah, it's amazing.
Hey, y'all. Just going to take a quick break from this conversation to let you know about the sponsor of today's episode. That sponsor is, well, frankly, it's me. It's Lee Brown University. It's no secret that real estate is crazy competitive, getting more so every day. And that's why I created Lee Brown University. Each of you has different goals. There's something in my course that's going to help you break through. So enroll in Lee Brown University today. You go to www.leebrownu.com and I'll see you there. Now, back to this amazing content.
So I just sold a flip. It closed today. And so now I'm going to do it with my proceeds. How do I get into self-storage when, as a developer, you're putting together it just asphalt and concrete and steel, but there are three of the most expensive materials out there right now. Is it investor buy into this stuff? Are these on syndicates or are there investment groups? It's not really a REIT product, is it?
I believe that there are all of those variations to get into self-storage. And keep in mind, too, there's different levels of self-storage. You know, we build only Class A assets, meaning there are 80 to 100,000 plus square foot. They're generally brand new or they're completely reconditioned. If we do a value add, we'll get to that level. Let's say you buy something that's 20,000 square foot, we'll add 80 onto it. So everything that we're left with after we're done is a Class A asset. And I specifically do it for this purpose. And that is, I want to attract the big boy. I want to attract the Cube Smarts and the extra space and the life storage. I want them to A, manage my facility and fight for that opportunity to manage it because that's a big piece of the, you know, the territory that they're looking at. And I want to set myself in position to be bought out at some point. It doesn't have to be this year. It doesn't have to be 10 years from now. I just want an asset that like a REIT or a mutual fund or like one of the, you know, big players on Wall Street is going to go, hey, you know, put 100 of these together and we're going to write a big fat check with lots of zeros. So that's just how we do it. But to answer your question, you can buy facilities for a couple hundred grand that are, you know, 10,000 square foot, you know, manage them yourself and self-govern and add a little bit on as you grow. I mean, there's a lot of ways to get your foot into the industry. That's just how we do it. We syndicate deals and we buy big development sites that are going to be worth 15 to 25 million when we're done.
And remember, friends, if you're new to the idea of syndication, make sure you watch some of the previous episodes where we talk about different kinds of syndication. But best way I can describe it is you and your buddies bought a case of beer together and everybody's putting some money in to get the case of beer. You all get some beer. And then what you're getting depends on who purchased the beer, whether you're getting PBR or Killian's, depends on who went out. And that's the operator who runs a syndicate.
That's right.
So here's my next question. So as you're looking at sites to build these out and you want to build something that's attractive to a hedge fund one day, more attractive to a CubeSmart right now, What is the primary checklist that you're working off of to put these in? Is it the demographics of the area? Is it the what you're going to have to do, site prep? What are the pieces you're most interested in?
Yeah, well, this actually goes back to, I'm going to answer that question, but it goes back to something you were talking about earlier, which is what is like our unique ability to find these deals? And one of the things that makes us, I don't want to say stand, there's other people doing this, but one thing that really times this right for this market is there's a transition in the industry in self-storage, and it's going from, you know, the old units that were like down a dark, dusty road in an industrial park, you know, surrounded by other industrial buildings, and, you know, they're kind of like scary and off the beaten path. And people now, consumers want stuff to be in downtown Main Street, off the main road, right where they're easily accessible. There's a huge consumer base of single females who don't want to take somebody with them when they want to go check on their stuff. They want to feel safe that they pulled into a well-lit location and there's cameras and they can punch in their code and they can go get their stuff and they can go back in their car, all in front of a retail shopping center or where there's other people around. And so what's great about that is there's a also on the other side of things, there's, I'm going to say great, and you know, it stinks for them, but it's great for us, is big box is dying. You know, your Circuit Cities aren't coming back. You got Sears and Kmart. And so what happens is we have these 100,000 square foot boxes that are sitting empty, generally in main downtown, Main Street, you know, USA. And so even though they might not be properly zoned for that, it's becoming more and more of a great story to sell to a zoning board or a municipality that, hey, would you rather have this big vacant box in the middle of downtown, or would you rather be converted into a self-storage? If there's less traffic, there's less parking, there's less of a lot of things. And I'm not really abusing the area as much as like a Kmart would as far as traffic and lights and traffic plans and all that. But I can turn it into a viable asset again, and nobody has to stare at an empty building. And so those two things colliding is really transitioning the industry as we're watching it happen.
I had no idea you could convert big box space into self-storage. And I guess because I haven't seen it here, and we get very tunnel vision into what we see in our own marketplaces.
Yeah.
What is the cost of conversion-ish? Because you don't have to do a lot. Basically, just dropping in some walls. You don't have to go back in and do water and sewer and insulation and all that unless you're doing climate-controlled units. I mean, mine are climate controlled, but they're not insulated.
Yeah. Now, it's going to vary greatly based on what asset you're buying and what the combination of things are happening. Like, we're doing a 21-acre site in upstate New York right now. But it's not just self-storage. We're taking a 100,000 square foot building. One of your biggest cost factors is your roof when you're looking at a big box, because your roof could cost you a fortune. So in that particular project, it's a 100,000 square foot building that we bought, and we paid $2 million for it. It just had a $1.4 million roof put on top of it before we bought it, because the prior buyer was trying to stabilize it and flip it to like an industrial, you know, logistics company. And the deal fell apart. So here I am with a 21-acre site, 100,000 square foot structurally sound building, and a $1.4 million roof on top of it before I get started. But the reason I'm kind of running around your question is, you know, in that site, I have, you know, triple net lease pad sites available. I'm converting half of it to retail. I'm adding garages out here. So yeah, the cost is way, way less, obviously, if you have an existing structure, but it really depends on your plan, what you're going to do with it, on the outcome of what it's going to be worth and what it costs you to do.
And by the way, friends, whether it's commercial property or residential, your two biggest expense items every single time are your foundation and your roof. And that's why you see so many multi-story buildings and two-story houses. You can get more space under those expensive item number one and on top of expensive item number two. So just remember that as you're like working through numbers in your head. So now, since you talked about that conversion piece, I have to ask a question that's starting to happen in the periphery of creative real estate, because obviously the markets shift, consumer behavior shifts, and there's a shortage of residential housing. We know that in a lot of areas, there have been people who will squat in their self-storage units, whether it's temporarily or not, because they've got nowhere else to go. Do you ever see a future coming where a facility that is currently storage turns into like a little tiny mini apartment kind of a complex? Because I don't think it's a far stretch when you look at container houses and the things that are happening just where people are squeezing into a room.
Yeah, you're not far off. I mean, there's a lot of, in fact, I had a meeting 2 weeks ago with my team talking about like what's the next 3 to 5 years as far as diversification of storage. Like when I think about self-storage, it's the concrete box, but there's all these little layers underneath of it. And, you know, we haven't talked about apartments, but what we have talked about is the mix of retail component with or office with storage. Another huge factor right now in American culture is that the RV, boat, and like adult toy industry, your jet skis and your quads and your those big razor things with the, you know, four-seater roof. But so they expect that market to go up by 75% in the next 2 to 3 years.
Really?
And so, yeah, so a big component is outdoor RV storage, indoor RV storage in certain areas. There's my partner up in Colorado does these massive, he calls them XXL units. They're basically like 15 foot wide and 45 feet deep. So you could pull a full-size RV into the unit and then they're heated. So what happens is you're paying a premium for that service. But guess what? If you're going to go every weekend for a drive for 3 days, you pull in, your stuff is in there, you can keep food, whatever you want in the RV, ready to roll. You don't have to spend all that time de-winterizing it or whatever you do to an RV. It's just sitting there parking ready to go for you. So there's a lot of that type of
dollars for the RV. So they probably are glad to pay for sheltered cover for it.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought about 75%, but now it makes sense because our generation, you're obviously in the medium years like me, our people now have the disposable income to buy toys, but may live in a community where you have covenants and restrictions against parking it, but you still want it.
Well, and that and travel restrictions, right? If you have disposable income and you were going to go spend whatever amount of money on a vacation, and now it's been 3 years and you haven't flown anywhere, well, people are getting cramped up. They're like, I need to get on the road. So this RV thing is becoming a craze and it's big time affecting our situation as well.
Which would also mean you could probably create some kind of a partnership with these, they're not Airbnbs, but they're the short-term RV companies. There's like four different websites where you can rent an RV for 3 days. There's probably a whole nother subsidiary business there for you, Joe. I'm just saying you should totally.
Very much. Yep.
All right. So obviously I'm very interested in this because I just money burning a hole in my pocket. I need to go invest in something, but the story of the show is crazy shit in real estate, not what should leave around for money. So I'd love to know you, I know you came through the show and probably totally ready to tell us the craziest thing you've encountered. It could have been in your flipping days. There's always stories in flipping world. It could be in your self-storage days that when you are handed a glass of bourbon, you're like, y'all are never going to believe this. What's that story?
That's pretty funny. The story that always comes to mind for me is, you know, throughout the course of our time doing business, we did houses from 150 grand to 1.5 million, right? And at the same time, because in South Jersey, this is a historic area. There are houses that are 150 years old all the way to stuff that's 15 years old. And so when you're flipping, you really have to have your hand in all different range. You can't just pick and say, I'm going to do a planned unit community and they're all going to be 300 grand a piece. It just doesn't work that way. And so when I remember one story distinctly, this is years ago, but we did our first major new construction house. It was a $1.7 million listing price when we were done. So this is a pretty, for us, that's a massive house. I know if you're in California or Florida, that's a condo, but it was like a 5,000 square foot house. Yeah. So, I mean, it was a 5,000-6,000 square foot house. And we had just paid, you know, 400-500 grand for the land. And the land was smooth. There was a house that had been taken out, but I owned a third of where the original house was. So it was like three lots like this, and they subdivided them into one, two, three, but the house was taken away. Anyway, I get a call one day from our excavator who's digging for the foundation for the property. And he goes, we have a real problem. And I'm like, okay, what's the real problem? You know, immediately you're like, oh man, it's like an underground burial ground. Did you find bones? Like this is going to, you know, he sends me a picture of a tank, an underground oil tank. It was the largest tank I've ever seen in my life. It looked like a gas station tank. It was the size of a pickup truck. And it was right in the center of our foundation.
Of course.
So me and my partner look at each other and we're like, what do you do? First of all, we operate everything with integrity. So of course your mind goes to, well, how do we get this thing out of the hole? But then you're like, all right, I'm not doing that. It's illegal. I got to figure out my way around this. So I call my attorney. And of course he's like, you got to call the township and just tell them it's there and figure out what the next steps are. It's the only logical thing to do. So this goes on for about 45 minutes. We're sweating bullets. I'm thinking to myself, I'm 500 grand deep into a piece of dirt that I can't build on. Now what am I going to do? And inevitably we call the township, and this is a really strict, really tough building inspector who's like not the kind of guy that you even have conversations with, right? And we say to him, hey, we hit a tank. And he goes, oh, yeah, you're fine. Just take it out and throw it away. And we're like, what are you talking about? And he goes, Oh, I know about that tank. It was abandoned properly in 1996, and I have the paperwork sitting here on my desk. It was part of the subdivision package. We already talked about it. So here, meanwhile, the guy I bought it off of was a friend of mine, forgot to tell me that there was a 5,000-gallon oil tank underground, but it's been vacated and it's empty and it's really just trash. They considered it like trash. So he's like, yeah, just pull it out of the ground, throw it away. And after our hearts sank, you know, we turned around, we built a big, beautiful house and sold it. So that's my story.
So he didn't make you do soil testing around it to make sure it hadn't leaked or any of that?
No, because when they did it back in 96, what they do was pump it out. They would do a pressure test on it and then they would fill it with dirt. So meanwhile, after we found this thing, we figured out that it was like 3/4 of the way filled with soil already, and it was abandoned properly years ago. So it's literally just a piece of trash underground.
So by the way, if you're listening to this episode and you're a realtor or you're a normal person who's dealing with a house with an oil tank, you should know the rules have changed since that has come along, and you always have to be up to date with your current regulatory rules when it comes to environmental tank disposal, because there's Superfund, North Carolina Superfund is empty, of course, but now you can't fill it with dirt. It has to be environmental foam, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
Always ask lots of questions on anything environmental. But if you're wondering why Joe's heart sank, it's because of that, right? So if you're dealing with oil, you're thinking red flag. And that's also why, friends, if you ever notice a gas station goes away and nobody wants to buy the corner, that's why.
That's it.
Environmentally, just a nightmare. So you can make it a parking lot pretty easily. All right. So Joe, if anybody's listening to this episode or watching it and they're thinking, I need to get into self-storage, I need to learn from the best, I need to get into this, how do they reach out to you and to your fund and your people?
Yeah. So our website is investwithlegacy.com. And we've recently this year started what I believe is going to be the greatest self-storage mastermind in the country. It's called the Storage Syndicate. That's at storagesyndicate.com. And I really built it, you know, necessity is the mother of innovation, I think, is, you know, we had all these people bringing us deals. We had all these investors trying to get involved in deals. We had all these developers wanting to buy deals. So I put them under one roof and we call it the Storage Syndicate. And it's really meant for people just to do more business together, to have the resources to, you know, who do I design it from? Here's the architect. How do I get commercial lending? Here's the lender. How do I buy deals? Here's shovel-ready storage. You know, we'll be able to actually physically build and help folks get involved, whether they're just accredited investors or whether they want to bird dog deals and earn equity, or whether they're seasoned developers and they're just looking to access for more deals. And so it's been amazing. It's been a lot of fun to see the growth inside of there.
Well, all of those links are in the show notes for this episode. So you can go find the website, log in, learn some information, see if you're qualified to join the Storage Syndicate, and connect with Joe on social networks. Joe, thank you for coming on the show and giving us a lot of deep dive information into this really interesting space.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Great show.
All right, guys, make sure that you subscribe for more, click the bell, and leave some nice words down below in the comments for Joe. It'll make him a happy camper. You can also thank him for his service to this amazing country down there, and you can say go Navy, or you can also say oorah, because Marine Corps is a little bit attached to the Navy, but probably don't say go Army, because then the page will blow up and that's how things go. And most important, make sure you come back to the show in the future, because there's always going to be something new on Crazy Shit. And I'll see you next time.
As always, I'm so super thrilled that you joined in for more Crazy Shit. And if you're a realtor, investor, inspector, lender, or just a regular human being who happens to have an unbelievable story that you need to tell the world about, or frankly, you just need to one up the story you just heard, then make sure to DM me on Instagram at Lee Thomas Brown, or tweet me at Lee Brown, or frankly, any social network where you hang out. I'm there. And if you had some fun, then you totally want to subscribe so you don't miss out on any future episodes.